Welcome once again to another rocking edition of Radio Otherwear. And this week I've got such an exciting show lined up that we've hardly got any time to spare. So I'm just going to say a very, very quick hello to everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in once again. And if you're not already aware, Otherwear is anything that activates, enhances, or evolves the multidimensional inner spiritual technologies that all of us have as our birthright. So that's what this show is all about investigating, and I'm sure that you'll find David Sarita, our guest this week, has many things to share that will help you in your own quest to unlock your otherwear. And for those of you out there who are particularly interested in the UFO field, I know that you are going to love this show, because David has produced one of the most stunning DVDs that has ever been made, with one of the most interesting and knowledgeable voices on the subject, Dan Aykroyd. And Dan Aykroyd is the first celebrity ever to apply brains and wit to disclose the real UFO phenomenon to the world in his new film, Dan Aykroyd, Unplugged on UFOs. No Hollywood celebrity has ever come forward to tell us the truth, as Aykroyd proclaims. Let's get past the debate on whether they're here or not. Let's start to analyse who they are, what their intentions are, and how we can utilise this technology to better ourselves as a species. Many of you will know him, of course, from the film Ghostbusters, which was one of my first introductions to Dan Aykroyd. Of course, some of the other great movies that he's been in are Blues Brothers, Dragnet, Sneakers, and many, many more. And it's been his personal hobby to know the truth about UFOs. He is a self-sponsored researcher and has been since he was first aware of the UFO wave as a child. He learned about Kenneth Arnold's sighting in Washington in 1942, as well as learning about the Roswell incident. And in 1986, Dan and his wife Donna saw two UFOs from their home in Martha's Vineyard, which was confirmation for him that UFOs were real. And David Sarita, the producer and director of Dan Aykroyd, Unplugged on UFOs, who is a resident of Los Angeles in California, worked from 1995 through to 2001 at the request of Martin Stubbs, who video catalogued over 400 hours of live NASA broadcast missions, and Michael Boyle, who is a professional photographer associate of Mr. Stubbs, conducted a deep scientific investigation into the scientific community at NASA and outside of the agency into the 1990s space shuttle mission video footage of unidentified flying object phenomena. The results of that investigation led to the development of the book and documentary film Evidence: The Case for NASA UFOs, which came out a couple of years ago and is definitely well worth seeing. David Sarita has also held positions such as director of the LA-based Tesla Foundation, where he promoted breakthroughs in non-radioactive nuclear energy, solar power and hydrogen fuel technologies. He was president of the Green and Blue Corporation, a California-based eco-venture capital company, and president of High Energy Micro Devices. He also helped market a revolutionary oil spill cleanup technology called Oil Gator and became co-founder with Miss Sean Mussel of the Native Elders Video Library Archives, a non-profit California-based foundation developing a video library of Native American Indian elders' oral teachings and wisdom. David Sarita's first aspiration in life was to become an astronaut. In 1968, he and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses, and after this experience, he grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy and science led him on a career in related fields. He's worked deeply in high technology, on environmental and humanitarian issues, and as a professional photographer for over 20 years. He has studied world religion, science, physics, and paranormal psychology for over 25 years, and he has joined us on Otherwear today to give us the juice on a hot new DVD called Dan Aykroyd, Unplugged on UFOs, as well as some information about his new book called Singularity, and a whole lot more. Hi, David, and welcome to Otherwear. It's wonderful to have you take some time out to join us.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
Well, you've got such an incredible and very impressive, I must say, resume and background, and there's so much that I'd love to talk to you about, but today I really want to focus on, you know, who you are, how did you get to where you are today, and all about, of course, the new DVD, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs. So who are you, David? Besides all of that other stuff that I read out, you know, who are you?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I ask myself that question every day when I meditate. I've been meditating for, I just got up from my meditation when you called. Well, really, you know, who we are is just a collection of, you know, how we respond to our environment, the world around us, and the universe, and what we decide to identify with. And for me, you know, I could have did the long and skinny, straight and narrow path and been a doctor or a lawyer like my two parents. My dad's a psychologist, Lynn Sarita, who was getting his PhD in Berkeley in the 60s, and I remember the Vietnam War protests and the tear gas riots, and all of that really shaped me in the beginning. And, you know, on my way home from elementary school one day, I saw a UFO, and crowds of people were pointing up at this thing, and it's just a classic dish-shaped UFO with a little knob on the top, and it was so close that if I would have had a video camera today, it would be the best UFO footage in the world. I mean, right now. It's very rare that these things get down that close, except for, you know, in cases like, you know, the Billy Meyer incident in the Swiss Alps, and there are a few cases where UFOs get this close. But in broad daylight with, you know, just in the local neighborhood in Albany and Berkeley, that day there must have been, I mean, I saw at least 50 people, so I can't even imagine how many more there were in the Bay Area seeing it. And it was hovering for a good 20 minutes, and when I went home, I thought, you know, it must have been the Starship Enterprise, because I used to watch Star Trek back then with all my brothers, and I knew, you know, this isn't real. I used to watch My Favorite Martian, and, you know, part of me thought, you know, we had this technology already. But then, because I built model airplanes, even at, you know, 6 years old, I knew that, you know, this thing was something not of this world. And very quickly, when I asked my parents, my new stepfather, David Cooper, I asked him, and, you know, he was studying to be a science teacher, and, you know, they just didn't know what to say to me. But I started having these dreams, and the dreams were of one set of lights spinning in a circle on clockwise and another set of lights going anti-clockwise. And that was part of, you know, the first kind of telepathic communication I had probably with the ETs who were trying to teach me about their propulsion systems. And that's kind of where it all started. When you have an experience like that, you never forget it. You never go, you know, okay, I'm just going to ignore that. Because eventually, as you get older, and as I got older, I remember in the 1970s, we moved from California to Canada, once again, to live with my real father. And I remember hearing about the Billy Meyer case on the news in Canada in the early 70s, and I was like, wow, that's what I saw. So I, you know, it kind of distracts you. And then when I went to high school in Canada, I just didn't fit into the, you know, stamped out mold. I mean, I was excited about learning, but I wasn't excited about being forced to learn the paradigm and the structures that the schools were trying to, you know, mold me into. There were too many questions I had, you know, zero point energy, God, you know, how did we get here in the universe, and my UFO experiences. So I just started becoming self-educated and started reading everything that, you know, no one else would point me towards. And I consumed myself in books and study, but I never got a PhD, never got a college degree. I'm kind of, a self-taught, you know, individual. And I look up to Einstein in that way, because Einstein said, learning begins when you forget everything you learned in school. I mean, real learning. And he actually never even had a PhD himself. He was a self-taught, you know, original thinker. So that's what I wanted to be.
And through all of this study that you've done, have you had your questions answered to your satisfaction?
Oh, yeah. My questions have been answered almost completely from a number of experiences I've had. My dad took me to this yoga retreat in the 1970s, I think it was, early 70s, and introduced me to an East Indian guru, and when I was at that retreat, and I didn't believe in any of this stuff. I was really negative and skeptical, and looked at this guru, and, you know, I was kind of open-minded, but I wasn't really into this stuff, and I meditated, and I did some yoga, and in the middle of the night, I felt this what is now known as sleep paralysis. I felt this, you know, black kind of energy crawling up my legs and paralyzing my body one limb at a time. And I almost interpreted it as evil, but something in me, even at that age, probably, you know, only 14 years old, just said, relax, you know, don't worry, you know, nothing bad is going to happen. And it was scary because when this black kind of energy crawled up my spine and got to my neck, I felt like I was being choked to death. And instead of, you know, fearing, I surrendered into the experience, and all of a sudden, there was this these three shining beings of blue light, who one would look like a half monkey, half human, who I never even saw a picture of these Hindu deities before this experience. And there was this man and this woman who were astoundingly beautiful, and they had so much light and spiritual energy shining from them, I couldn't stand up in their presence. But I could look at them very clearly and very easily, and I was just in awe of who they were. And the next morning I asked the guru, Baba Haridas, you know, about my experience, and he laughed and he said, that was Hanuman. And, you know, and the other two, I later learned, were Rama and Sita, which are forms of Krishna and his female consort. So luckily I got visited by these enlightened beings really early in life, and I knew right away this was real too. So not only did I have the UFO experience, I had my first experience with a divine encounter, and I thought, oh my God, you know, this stuff is for real. So I started meditating and meditating. By the time I was 18, I was meditating every day and practicing yoga and meditation and vegetarian diet and you know, never faltering. I mean, I've been meditating for 25 years now, and I don't falter in my practice. I may miss a day once in a while due to travel. Sometimes I'll sit as long as 7 hours, like a full day of sitting practice. You sit for an hour and get up and stretch your legs and sit for an hour, and then you have lunch and you keep going. And then sometimes I only sit an hour or even a half an hour. It depends on my schedule. But later, you know, much, much later in my life, you know, in my I went to India in 96, 97. I met the Dalai Lama. I studied intensive Buddhist practice for many years, doing intensive Vipassana meditation. Had incredible samadhi experiences where I went into states of oneness with everything, and those are just amazing.
Was this simply through meditation, or were you
just through practicing
things?
Intensive meditation? Yeah.
Right.
My dad held a retreat at our house, and my first girlfriend and I attended. And it's really hard. I mean, doing nothing is the hardest thing you can possibly do. Sitting cross-legged with your back straight on a pillow and not leaning up against the wall is excruciatingly painful. And the mind is so agitated, it just wants to, you know, jump around and do stuff all day. But my legs were killing me. My back was killing me. And I remember on the second day in the afternoon, I just had this huge explosion of ecstasy that started in my belly. It just exploded, and I started laughing like a mad Buddha, and I got kicked out of the meditation hall because I was so obnoxious, but I couldn't help it. I was literally merging with the universe, and when I walked outside, it's almost as if my body was a thin, vaporous, you know, sensation. I couldn't really feel it as strongly as I do right now, and I was just kind of, you know, bathed in this supernatural ecstasy that never stopped. It wasn't like an emotion where you get high and then you start, you know, getting really excited and then you come back down. This was steady. And when I walked upon these willow trees in the park, this was in Vancouver, as the wind blew through them, it tickled me. I literally felt everything those trees felt. And when the birds walked on the grass, I just started laughing because I was so sensitive. It was as if they were walking on me. I was
beautiful.
In this extended body of oneness. And then I looked up at the sun, and I could actually hear the sound of the sun, and all of the trees and the plants had this unique sound vibrations that blend into this symphonic sound of what the Hindus call the sound of Om that was permeating everything. And the physical universe appeared very translucent to me at that time. It wasn't solid like it is, you know, the way we mostly experience it. And that day changed my life. I was like, wow, I want more of this. I'm going to keep meditating and meditating and never touch, you know, drugs and all those things and alcohol and just staying very pure. And by the time, you know, I had had numerous incredible experiences. About 1986, 2 days before Christmas, in the middle of the afternoon, I thought I was dying. I got that same, what psychologist William James called vastation, or the paralysis. But my whole body started trembling, and I couldn't stand up, and I thought I was dying. And I lied down, and this explosion of ecstasy started in my belly, and I was taken, to make a long story short, I was taken through seven heavens and in God, and I heard thunderous angels singing and blinding light, and had this amazing journey through the cosmos, through these seven levels of heaven. And the first heaven is like a million orgasms of ecstasy and love and peace and beauty and wisdom and graces and beautiful qualities. The second heaven is a million times brighter than the first. So as I was approaching the barrier of the first heaven into the second heaven, the ecstasy was crushing me. It was like it was beyond my capacity. And I would call out to God and say, no, no, I can't take any more. I never even dreamed that enlightenment was going to be this good. And then I would go into the second heaven. And then in the second heaven, my new body was purified by a new supernatural energy there. I was told by God there were millions of paradise planets in that heaven. And I zoomed through it, and I went to the third. And the third was a million times more ecstatic than the second. And it got harder because it was the exponential increases in this glory of God were so huge that I was really having a hard time crossing from one to the other, because it's like you're overdosing with ecstasy, and then when you finally get into the new heaven, there's a new purification that allows you to be there. And I just couldn't believe it, just kept going. And when I got to the seventh, I only went to the edge of it. I couldn't pierce it. It was way beyond my abilities. I had already told God in the fifth heaven, you have to stop. You can't take me any higher. And even though I resisted, God just kept carrying me. And then the very next day, same time of the day, which is 4:15 in the afternoon, same time of the day that I was born, but, you know, not on that day, I went again through these same heavens, and I got to experience my past lives, and I got to, you know, learn so much from God, and the sound of the angels singing is thunderous and so beautiful, it makes the best classical music on earth seem really boring in comparison. And I wrote that whole experience down and archived it. And when I came back, I didn't retain any of that ecstasy. I didn't retain any of it. And I was so upset about it and depressed that the kingdom of heaven was real. I knew, you know, for myself that what I wanted to do was to communicate to others and tell them, look, you know, this is really worth it to follow this spiritual path. I mean, it's hard. Sometimes you meditate for years and nothing seems to be happening. But if you follow the path of the Buddha or Jesus or Krishna or any of the great masters, it really takes you to this incredible, truthful heavenly state. Whether you can experience it here on earth or whether you're taken out of the body, these states of what the yogis call samadhi are incredible. I mean, they make, you know, getting drunk or smoking pot seem so stupid and such a waste of time. It's unbelievable how much greater it is. But it's a lot of work. And what happens is the more I felt that I was one with the universe in some of these samadhi states, the more responsive or the more I responded to suffering. And one of the first things I saw was that, you know, that nature and the environment was really hurting, and I could feel it in the trees. And my girlfriend and I at the time decided to become tree planters, and
I remember that you planted over a million trees,
I worked over 22 years during the springs and falls, and sometimes in the summers in British Columbia, and I planted 1.3 million trees over 22 years. And it's you know, to be that intimate with nature is a sacrifice, because, you know, I have to leave my family, my friends for a long period of time and live in these camps. And, you know, I rarely ever had a girlfriend during those years because it was, I'm never around. I'm always in the mountains. So there's a real sacrifice, but at the same time, there's this intimacy with trees and nature that is maturing, you know, over time as I'm spending more time in the wilderness. And that I never regret. And that, what happened was, by the time I got into the 1990s, I founded with a Saudi business partner a company called the Green & Blue Corporation, and we set out to raise venture capital for alternative energy technologies, hydrogen fuel cells, helium-3 fusion technology, oil spill cleanup technology, And we had personal, close access to many of the richest people in the world. And this is, you know, early 90s. And every person, including Michael Jackson's business associate, Brett Strong, the Resniks who owned the Franklin Mint, Solomon Brothers, George Stranahan, who sold Champion Spark Plugs for $500 million cash. I met these people, you know, and my partner did in person. And every single rich person on the planet, Lloyd's of London, I mean, the head of Lloyd's of London in England, I went skiing with him, David Ambrumenthal. He was a really nice guy, but they just didn't want to do anything. Nobody really wanted to put money into alternative energy technologies and transform our situation. And I was so depressed. My company went bankrupt. I went tree planting again that year, which was 94. And when I got out of tree planting, the government of Canada fined me for back taxes that I owed, and they wiped out all the money that I earned tree planting that year. And I had no money, nowhere to live, the inability to pay rent anywhere. And so I phoned my dad, who was living in Topanga, California, and he was, you know, just, you know, moved into a small ranch house with horses with his wife, and they had almost no room, and they were renovating their house, and I ended up pitching my tent and living in his front yard. And I had my partner went back to Saudi Arabia. Our company was bankrupt, and he, you know, gave me the company car, which was this nice BMW convertible. So I was driving around L.A. in this nice car, and I lived in my tent. So I was pretty much a homeless guy. And then when the rains came in October that year, mid-October, I was flooded one night. I was in a gully in my little tent, and water came pouring in the front door, and I started to get hypothermia. And I was just so depressed. I could have gone in the house and gotten warm. And I said, I've had enough, you know. I just said, God, take me. I don't want to live in this world with these people anymore. Nobody cares about the earth. Not really. I mean, not the rich people who can really make a difference. And so I just surrendered. And when I did, I started to get hypothermic. When you get hypothermic, you get so cold that you can't feel hot or cold.
Yes.
It's like you're in limbo. It's kind of nice in a way because you're not really suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You feel almost as like you're vaporous. And I floated out of my body. I came upon the oak trees in the dark, and this was, you know, maybe 5 in the morning. There was no sunlight, you know, 5:30 in the morning. Just a little bit of light on the horizon, but, you know, above the clouds. And this giant crucifix made of dark stone granite was hovering there with a baptismal pool beneath it. And the crucifix was like humming like the monolith in the movie 2001 and 10, and just beckoning me and calling me to fall into the water to be baptized. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I know I'm out of my body. And I fell into the water in spirit, put my arms out in the shape of a cross, and then all of a sudden, what the Christians call the Holy Ghost just swept over my body and just wiped out every tear, every emotional pain, every wound I ever had. And just to get rid of my pain was so amazing, but there was no bliss. I just felt like I was in this kind of limbo where there was no pain, but it was nothing, you know, ecstatic or anything. And then
like
a mother picking a baby. What's that?
A little bit like anesthesia?
It would be like that. And then all of a sudden, like a mother picking a baby in her arms, I was carried up above the rain clouds, and I saw a faint light on the horizon, and I'm like, wow, you're dead, and, you know, you're really dead now, and where are you going? And these little tiny atoms, like diamonds, the most beautiful little diamonds, millions of them, from every direction, below, above, beneath, all directions, came rushing together, and this huge, oceanic, thunderous sound materialized the body of Jesus Christ right in front of me. And as soon as I saw him, I fell on my face, physically and spiritually could not stand up in my spirit body. And in one second I knew, oh my God, this is God. Jesus is the supreme being. He was 1,000 times brighter than the sun, and not just the physical light, but that he shined with the entire universe of love and ecstasy and peace and power and beauty and wisdom and graces. And it was all hitting me at once. And as I looked at his body for one second and looked at his face, I went, oh, the whole universe is coming from that one being. And I knew in that instant that I was his. That was it. My search for my guru, if you will, was over. I had met even, you know, out of body, these other Hindu deities. I had met tens of different gurus from India. I had been to India, and I loved, and I still love all of those teachers. But for me, this was it. This is the Supreme Being in front of me. And he, first thing he said to me was, I have appeared to a number of people throughout history, but at different levels of their spiritual ability. No one has ever seen me in my entirety. Even now, you were not seeing me in my entirety. It is not possible at this time. And as he said those words, each word had millions of causations and that were so perfectly clear to me in definition that no one in the universe had seen him in his entirety because there was simply no one beyond him. And that was just devastating to see one being, one tiny little, you know, beautiful being that had all the power of the whole universe. And he was so innocent looking and so beautiful. I just wept in tears at his feet. And he started to talk to me about the universe, about what happens when we die, how judgment really works, about where human beings were, how we got here, the fall in the Garden of Eden. And he was just going over things with me. And by the time I finished my meeting with him, I was so instantly healed. My body had no illness. I never even got a cold, a sniffle. I never sneezed. I just ran into the house and I told my dad, I just met God. And he looked at me like, he was so busy, he was like, yeah, yeah. And I was like, you don't understand, I met Jesus last night, and I saw him, and I met him, and he kind of stopped. But I really had a hard time telling my dad, because my dad was, we're a Catholic by, you know, baptized at birth, but we're not practicing Catholics. And my dad, you know, had been studying, you know, gurus from India. And I had a hard time telling him that Jesus isn't a saint. You know, Dad, he's not a prophet, you know, like the Muslims think he is. That this is, he's exactly who he says he is. And he's not a liar, and he literally is the Supreme Being. And that was tough for me, because initially I was taught that, you know, all of these saints were they're in a state of oneness, but they're not, their levels of enlightenment are not all the same. I mean, there are different levels of enlightenment, and clearly there was no being, you know, that compared to this. So that was a iconoclasm for my spiritual practice. I had to reform my views. And I started doing my Buddhist meditation and doing Christian prayers and studying the Bible and, you know, reading the Nag Hammadi Library and all the missing Gospels of Jesus I've studied, and studying Elaine Pagel's work at Princeton on Jesus, and really, really getting to know, you know, who he really is. And then I could find in some of these secret manuscripts, you know, the same words that Jesus spoke to me were clearly there. And so that was kind of a big change. But in the middle of the years that Jesus appeared to me first in 94 in October, Easter morning 97, I saw him again, and it was even more amazing. And then he appeared to me, the last time he ever appeared to me was in 1999. And that was it. I wrote a book on it called Face to Face with Jesus Christ. My publisher stole it from me. He took $18,000 from me to promote it, which he never used, and it sells on Amazon, and I have nothing to do with it, and I just let it go. Wow. But in the middle of all that, I was doing, in the middle of an investigation on NASA space shuttle UFO phenomena, and that's where I, you know, eventually completed the film Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs, and got Dan Aykroyd interested in that film. He did a cameo interview in the beginning of the film, and he wrote the foreword to the book. And that was kind of the beginning of my kind of public investigative disclosure on the UFO phenomena. Well, then what happened was I would always have dinner with Dan when he came into town, and I was like, oh, my God, he's so brilliant. I mean, Dan is like, I mean, he's like Einstein in a comedian's body, and he's so knowledgeable. He knows everything, politics, war, history, UFOs, anti-gravity technology. I mean, if you mention something to Dan, he knows so much about it already. He says, blows your mind. And I'm like, nobody in Hollywood knows this about you. Nobody really knows how brilliant you really are. And we got to sit you down one day in front of a video camera and just let you talk. And so we decided to do that. And then, you know, we filmed Dan on the set of a movie. And it eventually became this movie, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, which comes out worldwide May 30th, and the trailer's at www.daufo.com on the internet for people who want to see the trailer.
Well,
and really, to me, he is such a special human being. I mean, he's the first celebrity who has taken the issue seriously and disclosed it as a truth publicly and put his name and life on the line to this subject. I mean, I met David Duchovny from The X-Files, you know, by accident one day, and I came up to him, and he said to me, I don't believe in UFOs. And I was like, how could you not believe in UFOs? You were on The X-Files for 9 seasons. And he said, I just don't believe in them. And I was so shocked.
I'm shocked.
In fact, one of the guys from The X-Files, Dean Heglin, his office is right across the street from our house here in L.A., and he came over a couple times for tea, and we talked. He was the lone gunman, eventually got their own show on Fox with Chris Carter from The X-Files. But they were the kind of three tech guys that, you know, Mulder would go to to get, you know, inside information. He believes in UFOs. Apparently, Dana Scully is a true believer, the real Dana Scully, Gillian Anderson.
Yeah.
But Fox Mulder is not a believer. It really blew me away to hear him say that.
Well, when we come back, we've got to take a quick break, David. When we come back, we'll get right into how Hollywood has treated the whole UFO and ET subject. And I'm going to have to ask you a couple of questions about Jesus. Because, you know, you didn't really give me much of a chance to respond to that. But I have to. I definitely have to. So when we come back, David Zurita will be telling us a little bit more about Unplugged on UFOs, the new DVD with Dan Aykroyd, as well as the Sirius Connection, Dropper Stones, and a little bit more about anti-gravity, singularity, and the theory of everything. And you can catch him on the web at www.davidsarita.blogspot.com. This is Otherwhere, and I'm Liz Miller. We're back on bbsradio.com and you're listening to Otherwhere with David Sarita and Liz Miller. And that was a track from Will Milton entitled Gravity, out on King Street from New York. And don't forget you can find them on the web at kingstreetsounds.com. Please support them as they support us here at Otherwhere. No Hollywood celebrity has ever come forward before to tell us the truth about ETs, as Dan Aykroyd has done on this new DVD. And I'd like to find out, what exactly is your role in putting out this DVD? I know that you've had a friendship with Dan for quite some time, and it sounds like it all came about really organically, the two of you working together, which is wonderful. But are you actually the producer of this DVD, or how do you fit in?
There's two producers. There's myself and John Johnson, my partner. We both shot and edited the film. I'm the director, and I co-star in it with Dan. I'm kind of the host, you know, asking him questions, and there's this, you know, this amazing footage of UFOs and other military, you know, videography and, you know, illustrative film going by in the background as we're having this amazing dialogue about UFOs. And the UFO footage is real. It's all real. To the best of my knowledge, from my own experiences of seeing UFOs, it's some of the best footage out there. A lot of it's very current. And, you know, some of it is available on the Internet, but really small little, you know, pixelated video images. And, you know, it's nice for people because they can see it full screen for the first time. But it's really amazing just to sit down with someone like him. Because you consider, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind was the first, you know, blockbuster film of my era. I mean, you had The Day the Earth Stood Still, and you had, you know, Star Trek as a TV series, My Favorite Martian. And then Close Encounters made about $390 million worldwide in 1977, I think it was. And when you convert that to today's dollars at the U.S. Institute of Economics, they have an inflation calculator. It comes to $1.1 billion. So it actually is equal to the Titanic. But then when you take a movie like E.T., which was early 80s, which made close to $1 billion in its day, when you convert it with inflation to today's dollars, it's $1.6 billion. So it clobbers the Titanic. And you see these amazing films that Spielberg was making that were really true and genuine to the phenomena. And none of his extraterrestrials were coming to destroy the world. He didn't do that until he did, you know, War of the Worlds. Mm. And when he did War of the Worlds last year, comparatively, it didn't do anywhere near as well. But what that tells you is that people want to see movies about, you know, not about a monster who's coming to kill us, about, you know, enlightened extraterrestrials who are coming here to take us to a higher level, because that's what, you know, those two blockbuster films were doing.
Well, let's talk about the way people think about ETs in general at the moment. 80% of Americans, according to a recent CNN poll, believe that they exist and that there is a cover-up going on from within the government. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, 8 in 10 people are walking around thinking, yeah, they're out there, and out of those 8 people, you know, there's probably a pretty healthy number within that who believe that they're benevolent or that they are not just negative. So why do you think Hollywood has turned its back on making friendly ET movies, and especially Spielberg? You know, I could never really get my head around his motivation behind making War of the Worlds and indeed even the series Taken.
Well, yeah, Taken was all about, you know, aliens who wanted to use mind control.
Absolutely.
And control us in the end. And then, of course, about the big one, you know, War of the Worlds, was a remake of the H.G. Wells classic. So, you know, he was being true to the story, but he somehow got attracted to the dark side of E.T.'s, and you know, The X-Files was very dark as well. I mean, there was one character who was this, like, this enlightened man who could heal, and you rarely saw him on The X-Files in relation to UFOs, but somehow he went to the dark side of the UFO, you know, mysticism, and it just didn't do as well. It didn't sell as well, but it still sold a lot. And maybe Hollywood, you know, Hollywood, I wrote a screenplay in the late 80s called Angel of the Sea, which was the opposite of The Exorcist and Poltergeist, about a little girl who's getting visited by angels of light, And it's very similar format, story format, but none of it's negative, and it's for children. Disney turned it down. Spielberg turned it down. Nobody would do my movie about an angel. But if you're going to do a movie about the devil, you know, like this new movie 666 coming out, you know, about the Antichrist, Hollywood just lines up, and it really makes me wonder why they really believe audiences would rather see the devil rather than God and angels. And
I don't agree that they believe that, because if the box office figures over the last 2 years they've fallen so drastically. It's obvious people have stopped going out to see these movies, yet they're still making them. So I really think it's more about them trying to push a particular idea or belief onto us rather than...
They might be, but, you know, mostly in the movie business, from what I've learned, it's all about money and what they think is going to sell. But it is true. There is an agenda, I think, in Hollywood. There is a lot of control and, you know, about the information that we get. And maybe they don't want us to know the higher truths. I mean, look at this guy in the BBC just interviewed Gary McKinnon, this computer hacker in England who hacked into the NASA computers, the Army, you know, and Navy and military computers in the United States for 2 years. And all he's doing is looking for proof of UFOs, free energy technology, and he finds evidence. He gets into a NASA computer and he sees them retouching photographs from the space shuttle of real UFOs, and he actually gets to see a real UFO photograph from NASA. And, you know, he didn't harm anybody physically. There's nobody dead because of him. If anything, he just showed the military how bad their security systems are. And if anything, they should hire the guy to help them improve their systems. But instead, he could face up to 70 years. He's being extradited from England to come to the United States for trial. And really, he's just an innocent guy who wanted to know the truth. You know, an absolute confirmation, something that millions of Americans and, you know, people all over the world want to know. They want to know, you know, have we made contact? Have you reverse engineered UFO technology? And why aren't we using that technology to better ourselves today and to get beyond this whole, you know, primitive oil and, you know, fuel technology society? And he's really a genuine guy, Gary McKinnon. I don't see why we would put him in jail. I mean, I understand it's illegal to go into these military systems, but at the same time, he really didn't harm anybody physically. I mean, he might have done a little bit of damage to their computers, but hardly anything, really. So,
well, the whole point is that if he is disclosing to people that he's found proof, and that is exactly the opposite of what the government want the people to know, then, of course, they're going to want to put him away.
Well, so then again,
you know, a long time.
They would, if that's really why they're putting him away, then why don't they put every UFO researcher away, like Stanton Friedman? And there's a huge list of UFO researchers that they don't.
Well, they don't hack into government databases.
No, they're not. I mean, and this guy has found proof, but he doesn't bear the proof. He didn't, you know, put it in a form that we can see.
Mm.
But I believe him. I believe everything
Gary
thinks.
Oh, I do too. I think what he's done is remarkable. Absolutely.
Yeah, he's
going
to be a legendary hero. If he ever goes to prison, he will be, like, to me, like Leonard Peltier. He'll be like a political prisoner.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great, you know, I mean, he will have sacrificed his life for the truth. And it's just not fair. So I got last night the Coast to Coast AM site to put up the BBC interview. And BBC is fantastic here because, you know, even in, I got this magazine that reminded me of it, Information Weekly was running the story about him and how military generals are calling it the highest profile, you know, computer hacking case of all time. But they never mentioned the UFO part of the question, which is his main reason for doing all the hacking. Mm. It's like they keep ignoring that. But really, he's a great hero, and I hope to, you know, get people to sign the petition. There's an online petition where we can try to, you know, protest his incarceration and hopefully the prison sentence can be reduced.
There is a link to that petition on the bbsradio.com webpage that you can click on. If you click on show info for Otherwhere, which you can see on the Saturday schedule, click on that and you'll find the link there. So please go and check it out and put your name to it.
But really, the Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFO movie is really a first, because it's one movie that has so much information, so many of the challenging questions about the UFO phenomenon, and so much footage and photographs of UFOs all in one place, with probably the best personality, the most knowledgeable person in Hollywood on the subject, and that's Dan Aykroyd. So, if he goes to jail, I'm going to send him a copy, and hopefully he can watch it.
How long has Dan Aykroyd been researching UFOs? I know that.
Oh, his whole life. It just goes all the way back, and that's one of the questions I asked him. You know, he had experiences. He saw the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, and he remembered the sighting over the Washington, D.C. Capitol. There was these famous photographs of UFOs hovering over the state capitol building in D.C. It was in Life magazine during an issue when Marilyn Monroe was right on the cover. And that was the first thing that got him hooked, what is this? And then he got into ghosts, the paranormal. I mean, all of that stuff. Ghostbusters was a fun way for him to have fun with the ghost phenomenon, but he's actually very generally interested in that, too.
Oh, I thought it was quite funny, actually, when I heard that he had put this DVD out. First of all, I thought, wow, that's amazing that he's coming out to speak so candidly on this subject, and obviously mm-hmm. is very knowledgeable about it. But considering he's the man that brought ectoplasm to the world, it was pretty hilarious that he was also the first Hollywood actor to come out and speak so publicly on UFOs. Tell me a little bit more about what you'll actually see in the DVD.
Well, it's shot on video, which has a real kind of look to it, and it's what you're going to see is, Dan close up, and very provocative questions about the subject. And one of the questions I asked is, I believe this truly that, although I believe in world peace and oneness, historically, any great nation that gained a massive military advantage, such as the advent of the nuclear, atomic bombs, they, with that technology, use it as in intimidating fashion to oppress other nations. And other nations fear going to war with that nation because of their advantage. I mean, it happened with Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, any of the great conquerors. It wasn't that person was so fierce. It was that their armies and the technology they were using their armies was superior. And, when China invaded Tibet in the, right during the time the Geneva Convention on Genocide was signed, they started invading Tibet in the 1950s and 60s, and they killed 2 million Tibetans. They invaded a country, and they kicked them out, and they've been murdering them ever since. Now, what would happen today if, right now China is spending $20 million on a UFO research center? They're studying, taking it seriously in their universities in Iran, in Russia. No, we're laughing at it here. We don't study it in our universities. We keep saying it's not real. In England, it's the same deal. There was a new report recently that came out, probably in response to Gary McKinnon's interview, that, we decided we've researched all UFOs and they're just natural phenomena. Sorry, it's not real. As if any of us believe that. But anyway, that's what's going on. And the real thing here is, the next big revolution in aerospace is anti-gravity. I have an individual who's a retired U.S. Air Force colonel from World War II who's advised 3 presidents on UFOs. He calls me every couple of weeks to talk about, my theoretical work on propulsion, UFOs, and aerospace. And he said UFOs are more classified in the U.S. government than the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb, for the very reason that the Manhattan Project was not secret enough. It was very soon that Russia got the bomb and other countries got the bomb, and pretty soon, we didn't have that upper advantage. That was the beginning of the Cold War. We both have the bomb, so what are we going to do? We're going to scare each other to death. Now, UFOs, anti-gravity technology, the first country who reverse engineers it will gain air superiority on this planet. An F-18 or an F-22 Viper is not going to outperform an anti-gravity machine. It can do high-speed turns on a dime, can stop and accelerate at enormous speeds, and this F-22 is going to be banking and making turns and, enormous G-force problems, and all these other weaknesses in their aircraft will be no competition for an anti-gravity machine. So if China figures it out first, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to conquer the world? I mean, we can't be naive here. I mean, I'm a spiritual person who doesn't believe in war unless it's the last resort that you are being oppressed by someone who's going to take away your right to pursue freedom and liberty and justice and happiness. Yeah. Now, that's what happened to the Tibetans. I fear for what would happen if China gained that advantage before us. So I asked Dan that question, you know, and his answer is remarkable, you know, incredibly knowledgeable.
Have you filmed much UFO footage yourself?
No.
No.
I haven't actually filmed any UFOs myself. By the time I got a video camera, when I was in Hawaii in the year 2000, I saw a lot of, you know, light craft UFOs, you know, flying around the Haleakala volcano and different parts of the island at nighttime. I mean, definitely real sightings, but nothing compares to the metallic craft I saw in the daytime in Berkeley in 1968.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about that metallic craft because you said that it reminded you, when you saw the news report in Canada about Billy Meyer, and you saw the craft on TV and you said that's what you saw?
Oh, exactly what I saw.
So you were seeing a Pleiadian craft, is that what you believe?
It could have been a Pleiadian craft. In fact, I remember after that sighting, I moved to Berkeley. I mean, we moved to San Francisco with my stepfather, David Cooper, and we used to play kick the can. And I used to look at the Pleiades when I was counting to 100 and everyone was hiding. And I didn't know why. I didn't know it was called the Pleiades. I just would lock onto that star system with my eyes. And I think it's possible because of that encounter that they implanted some knowledge of where they were from in my subconscious.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go on to talk about anti-gravity a little bit more, because you have basically produced a paper on propulsion systems in which you detail your theories on anti-gravity. Would you explain those a little bit for us here, please?
Well, basically, you know, we quickly learn in propulsion, which is the force we use to move our vehicles, our boats through water, aircraft through air mass, and rockets through space, is the Einstein's law actually prohibits mass, any type of, you know, vehicle from attaining the speed of light because of inertia and the increase mass law, which is that, for example, when you move a boat through water, the faster you go through the water pushes you back and makes you heavier in relationship to the water. So it requires, the faster you go, you encounter more inertia, resistance, making you heavier and heavier and heavier and resistance to the water. And therefore, you need more and more energy in the form of propulsion. And eventually, the lake will limit you or the submarine to the point that in order to go any faster, you're going to need the entire energy of the entire body of water, because you're going to be pushing so fast that you're going to want to move that whole body of water. That's where Einstein says that eventually, you know, as you approach the speed of light, you need an infinite amount of energy to go any faster, even a millimeter faster, as you approach the speed of light, because of that reason. Now, when you move a jet through air mass, the same thing happens as the boat, except you can go a little bit faster. You know, we've got, you know, airplanes doing Mach 2 right now and a little bit past Mach 2, which is not very fast, you know, 1,500 miles an hour, roughly. So the speed of light is 670 million miles an hour. So we're nowhere near that. And when we move rockets, the space shuttle does 18,000 miles an hour. We have some satellites that can do 35, 40,000 miles per hour, which is about the speed of a meteorite. So we're really slow right now, and that the reason is because of this inertia problem.
Well,
so what I discovered when I, you know, looking at UFOs, how they're doing it, how they're moving so quickly, how they defy gravity, as I look at really good videography of UFOs, you'll always see a metallic craft, but you'll see these spinning waves around it that kind of blur a lot of the light. That's why sometimes you see structure, metallic sheen and shine from the sun, but then there's this wave. And I remember seeing that very clearly in the UFO I saw in Berkeley that day in 1968. And that is the signature of their propulsion system. Essentially, when you look at what matter is, you know, steel, the human body, it's just particles and waves. Now, if you can build a wave generator in your spaceship to transform the wave state of matter, you can put it into a transform that can change everything and open up the possibility of much faster velocity movement. So
Can I just butt in there and ask you, did you come up with this idea through the experiences that you've had with meditation and with your near-death experience?
Well, I was being taught, you know, step by step, my way towards the, what I believe is the answer to propulsion through some of my divine encounters with Jesus, and there were other many other encounters I've had since then. But because if I remember the first dream that I had about the lights spinning in two different directions on the same axis, it's eventually leading me to where I want to go. I mean, I didn't really understand the significance of that dream until I was in my 30s. I'm in my 40s now. And then what happens is when I started looking at infrared and near-ultraviolet invisible photography of UFOs from the NASA space shuttle missions, I could clearly see the wave patterns on the UFOs. In fact, they show up really well in infrared because space is so cold. It's minus 273 degrees as a background atmosphere. And when a wave, a magnetic wave or any type of a wavelet moves through it, it produces a friction trail, which gives off a little bit of heat, and it shows up really well in infrared cameras. Well, you can see these wave patterns really clearly, and when I study them, essentially what I had to do is I had to, because we look at wave particles in physics in two spatial dimension models right now, which is just up and down like a graph, a little bobbing up and down line, I got really frustrated with the two-dimensional model, and I designed the galactic clock to look at wave-particle relationships in all four dimensions, three spatial dimensions plus time. And I no longer use the flat two-dimensional plus time model that we use today. So because of that, I was able to look at my waves and my UFOs much more clearly and understand what they're doing and studying quantum physics, you know, looking at models of the atom and smaller and their wave formations. Over a period of years, I discovered, oh, my God, I know what they're doing. They're producing waves that are reducing the mass-gravity effect. In fact, mass, as we know it, human flesh and spaceships, boats and you know, air vessels, are just in an illusory state that we call matter. But when we look at it on the quantum level, it's just particles and waves. Now, if you can transform those waves and you can reduce the mass-gravity effect down towards zero, heading towards this zero-point formula where you're tapping into zero-point energy and you're reducing mass and gravity at the same time, eventually your ship gets close to zero, and it never reaches absolute zero, but it gets really close, and essentially your ship, your spaceship, turns into light. It doesn't weigh anything anymore. It doesn't encounter inertia anymore because it starts to go into such a high-frequency spin state at the atomic level that the pilot and the craft are they're in such a high frequency state that gravity has no effect over them anymore, so they can make high speed turns and experience no G forces, and they can eventually accelerate towards the speed of light with tiny amounts of energy rather than the enormous amounts of energy required in Einstein's formula. So Einstein is correct, mass cannot attain the speed of light, but if you transform mass, it can, and that's where my work is. So I've gotten very specific about what those wave models look like. And I zoom in on video frames of UFO footage. I look at the wave patterns. In fact, recently I've actually developed a schematic of a UFO propulsion system that I'm sharing with certain individuals at NASA and other places who are interested in my work. So that's where all this has gone for me. It's not just about being in awe of the phenomena. I want to know how these things work because one day we will be able to do the same thing. I mean, it's really frustrating when you think about it. We're on this little planet. It's a beautiful planet, but it's such a myopia to be stuck here and to, you know, with the advent of the Hubble Space Telescope, to see how big our universe is, and it's like, sorry, you can't move around out there. You can't even get to your nearest planet, Mars, let alone go outside the solar system. And it's like we're just beginning to see the possibilities now. We're not even close to reaching our full potential.
Oh, and absolutely.
UFOs just beckon us with technology that has already attained this. So let's learn from them, and let's reverse engineer their technology so we can benefit from it. So that's where all this, for me, is going. It's really a love of wanting to be an astronaut, not being able to do that. The only thing I could ever do was skydive 200 times and do high altitude skydiving, which is a lot of fun. And that's it. It's about learning from these great beings. And I really look at them the way Spielberg did in the beginning. I mean, think about it. If you can traverse the universe, if you can go from here to Andromeda and back on a spaceship, why would you come here to kill everybody and eat them in your, you know, like in War of the Worlds? There has never been a mass invasion of our planet by another species for thousands of years. The only thing that the ancients described to us in ancient Mesopotamia and Sumeria in Egypt is they had encounters with extraterrestrial beings who taught them math and astronomy and advances in science and architecture, and they left. Why would they come here to kill us? They can go anywhere in the universe. They can get any mineral, there's nothing we have that they can't get somewhere in the universe. They don't need to come here to eat us. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The ones that can jump galaxies, I just can't imagine why they would want to hurt anybody. There's no reason to.
Oh, I agree with you. I think there are many different types of consciousnesses out there, as many different types as there are races. So we're dealing with, you know, a whole gamut of different beings and different agendas and different levels of consciousness and different points of origin from the sounds of it as well. So, yeah, it's such a huge subject. In your DVD prior to this one with Dan Aykroyd called NASA UFO, you talk a little bit about the Dropper Stones and a connection with Sirius. Would you go into that as well, please? And the Dropper Stones, by the way, are disc-shaped and ancient artifacts that were discovered on the Tibetan-Chinese border by some archaeology professors. And they have a spiralling configuration in the centre that leads to a square notch cut out of the side. And you've seen this exact same design in certain craft, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, on the NASA tapes and cameras that can see into the invisible ultraviolet. The invisible is an amazing area right now because the home little digital cameras people have, people are going on vacations all the time and downloading their photos, and they're in the sky above their mother's head is a UFO, or, you know, above their friend, or just taking a picture of a farmer's field and there's a UFO. And that's one of the things, the first things I did in the NASA film is I found out that NASA was using special video cameras that can see near ultraviolet, infrared, and visible wavelengths. So our UFOs we're seeing could be interdimensional, invisible craft. Some of them measure 3 miles wide, making them motherships. I mean, people really need to see this film. And this is one of the reasons Gary McKinnon was so interested in getting proof from NASA that they really have made contact. Well, people can find out in that film. But anyway, some of these disc-shaped craft had these notches on the side. They were producing spiraling wavelets of energy that I was pulling out of some of the video frames. They're translucent. And, of course, on the Tibetan-Chinese border, 1936, Professor Sun Nui from the University of Beijing does an archaeology study on this village where the Hans and the Zopa tribe live on the Tibetan-Chinese border. They have a legend of a giant spacecraft that crash-landed in their mountains, and the inhabitants of the ship where they crash-landed are from the star system of Sirius, and in that tribal, you know, area, they found these Dropa stones that look identical to the craft we're seeing on the NASA UFO tapes.
And so it looks like some artists have gone and made some sculptures of them.
They made sculptures of them, and in their caves where they buried their ancestors from the star system Sirius, they had drawings of our solar system and little pea-sized dots that connected our system to the star Sirius. So eventually I make this connection to the star system of Sirius in the end of the film, that it's possible that we're being visited by Sirius, and Sirius is, of course, the home of the goddess Isis and Osiris, the chief, you know, the chief deities in the Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian religion,
yes.
Really.
Yeah.
And they claim that they came from the star system of Sirius. In fact, the word Nile, the Nile River, means Sirius in their language. So, in fact, pre-dynastic Egypt, individuals from Egypt migrated to Mali in northwest Africa to keep the knowledge about the Sirius star system secret, because the new dynasties in Egypt were destroying all that knowledge. And
are you talking about the Dogon tribe?
The Dogon tribe, yeah. The Dogon tribe were originally, their elders were from pre-dynastic Egypt, and they migrated to Mali. And
I had no idea about that. I thought that that they were African through and through and that they'd never actually migrated from anywhere else. That's fascinating.
No, no, they came from Egypt originally, and then there, of course, you know, they transferred the knowledge to the local elders who were then African, and then they kept the knowledge. But they knew more about the star system of Sirius in precise details than our modern astronomers did. And eventually we caught up and confirmed that everything they knew about Sirius was true. One, that it was a heavy star. Two, that Sirius had a B and C star that revolved around the main star every 50 years in an elliptical fashion, which is what the ancient Dogon tribe said. So if they knew everything about Sirius in such accuracy before we did, the question is, how truthful are they in saying that their ancestors came from there? I mean, they must be correct. So,
well, either that or they're really good at remote viewing.
Or they're really good at out-of-body or remote viewing.
Yeah.
I mean, but then they say there's a prophecy that the beings from Sirius will return, and when they return, there will be many moons in the sky. Well, when this particular incident happened on this particular space shuttle mission, STS-75, where we're seeing these dropozone-shaped craft that are 3 miles wide showing up on the shuttle's video cameras, the space shuttle was hovering right over Northwest Africa, their very location, and passes over ancient Egypt within minutes of the encounter. So it's really amazing. I mean, it can't be coincidence.
And when do you think that the Sirians or the Nomos will be back?
Well, I think they're already here. They're interdimensionally. See, this is where it gets really interesting.
This is what I really want to know.
The invisible presence, when you really understand that UFOs are showing up on digital cameras, but the human being only sees from red to violet, the rainbow spectrum of white light energy, and beyond that is ultraviolet near, ultraviolet far, ultraviolet extreme, X-rays and gamma rays. Well, we're only seeing a sliver of reality. Now, these digital cameras are able to see beyond that, and so are some film cameras and some video cameras. Now, because they don't necessarily want to make themselves physically, you know, disclosed because of the panic that it would cause to our civilizations if we had 3-mile-wide spaceships materializing over Manhattan and Los Angeles and London and so forth, and Sydney and wherever, we would go crazy. It would be like Independence Day, you know. We would not know how to handle it. But they can be vibrating with their craft in invisible dimensions and non-intrusively communicate with individuals through dreams. Now, John Nash, the physicist who in the movie Beautiful Mind, portrayed by Russell Crowe, he said in an interview with Quadrant Magazine in Australia that he was in contact with extraterrestrials and was receiving messages from them. In fact, in the book, it's very clear, the Beautiful Mind book, that that's what he said. Now, here's one of the greatest mathematicians of our time, who, in the book, the moment he does the math on proving invisible dimensions exist, he starts having interdimensional or parallel reality experiences, which even the physicist Richard Feynman proved actually existed. And he says he's receiving messages from extraterrestrials, and he's not so schizophrenic that he can't solve even the greatest math puzzles of his time. Every puzzle that no one could solve, he solved. And yet we call him schizophrenic and delusional, and we give him electric shock therapy and tell him this can't be happening, but he is saying that he's communicating and learning from ETs. Well, if we go further back in history to the great Greek mathematician Pythagoras, and we read the book Pythagoras, A Life, there's a whole section in there about how Pythagoras was receiving messages from extraterrestrials and lived in close association with a being named Astraeus, who was like a stepbrother to him, who taught him a philosophy of how many different beings are living in our own solar system. But many of these beings that we can't see with our naked eyes were vibrating at different, light frequencies, and we're traveling from one star system and one planet to another with light bodies. I mean, Pythagoras gets really philosophical about how they're actually doing it. It's very similar to my work. He says it philosophically. I show how that's possible in an actual quantum physics modeling. So it's two great mathematicians claim this, but in Pythagoras' time, you know, you don't call him schizophrenic. You call him a genius because he can see and communicate with beings in other dimensions, and he understands levels of math that many mathematicians today don't understand. In our day, if you say you're seeing ghosts or seeing interdimensional beings, you're crazy, and they electrocute you. But now, because with the advent of digital cameras and invisible sensitive photography, we can see proof that UFOs are in these invisible dimensions, and proof that, you know, there are ghosts showing up on people's, you know, film planes on their digital cameras, then we know these other dimensions exist. We can prove it scientifically, and we can also prove that it's not necessarily schizophrenia because you're able to see those dimensions.
And thank goodness for that. I am so glad that we are finally getting a little bit more enlightenment in that arena as well, because there are so many people who've been misdiagnosed over the years. It's a real tragedy, and it's about time that that ended. We're halfway through our interview with David Sirita. You're listening to bbsradio.com, and my name is Liz Miller. If you'd like to find out more about David, please check out his website on the World Wide Web. It's www.davidsirida.blogspot.com. And you can find out more about the documentary film Evidence, The Case for NASA UFOs at www.ufonasa.com. When Otherwhere returns, we're going to continue our conversation with David Sirita, and I'm going to be asking him about what he thinks about whether the ET races that are interacting with us humans here on planet Earth are helping or hindering us, what the singularity is, and we're also going to talk anti-gravity propulsion. So stay tuned, that's coming up next on Otherwhere. This is Otherwhere, and we're back. You've just been listening to the Ananda Project on King Street, a track from last year, 2005, called Shouldn't Have Left Me. That was the Auto Magic remix. And we're speaking with our guest, author, filmmaker, photographer, UFO researcher and environmentalist, David Sirita, who's just been talking about the new DVD, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs. What are the most compelling things you've seen footage of?
Well, really, the NASA material, for one, and there's a lot of footage out of Phoenix and Sonora, California, where that I used in my film.
Oh, yeah, Jeff Willis. Jeff Willis's,
Jeff Willis, Mark Olson,
yep.
Lynn Keitai's film, The Phoenix Lights, is amazing. There's over 10,000 eyewitnesses to the giant mile-wide triangular UFO that was, you know, seen all over the state of Arizona. And then, of course, it was videotaped, and everybody saw it on news stations all over the world. So, you know, when events like that happen and then the mainstream press covers it up, that's why you get numbers as high as 80% in favor of the UFO phenomena. That's why guys like Gary McKinnon are going to risk their life and their career and hack into government computers, because somebody knows more than we do. But it's possible that the government doesn't even know as much is people like I do and other UFO researchers and experiencers, because experiencers, the encounters are happening to them. It's happening to John Nash. It happened to Pythagoras. It happens to abductees. So they know more than the government does, because it's not happening to the government. But it's possible at some place like Area 51 they have reverse engineered, you know, UFOs, and they have anti-gravity, and they're not sharing it with us yet. And I think that's an international crime, because we need that technology to survive as a species. We are destroying the planet. It's all gone. I mean, we've lost 30% of the coral reefs. If you look at the oceans, seaweed, kelp produces 70% of the Earth's oxygen. Our forests produce the other, you know, 30-some-odd percent. We're destroying our rainforest, destroying our kelp beds. We're destroying everything. We're not going to survive if we keep going like this. So we need a higher level of technology, or what will probably happen is the Earth will destroy us.
Do you think that's going to be the scenario that's going to play out?
It could be why so many extraterrestrials, and why it's like the numbers of sightings. I mean, when you go to Rents.com, you're seeing sightings happening every week all over the planet. I mean, people are seeing UFOs all the time. This is a great question I asked Dan Aykroyd, is are we coming to an omega point, or meaning some massive event like at the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind and bigger, or is it just because everyone has more video cameras and we're seeing more sightings just because there's more witnesses? I don't think so. I think we're coming towards a point here. I don't think an extraterrestrial civilization could watch us destroy this beautiful living planet and just stand by idly and go, okay.
No, I don't believe that's possible either. I really don't.
No, they're too intelligent.
There's too much at stake. This planet is just is too valuable. There's too much life here and too much.
There's too many different beings here.
Yeah, there are too many different beings here. I don't believe that they could possibly stand by and let it happen. I do believe that they have certain constraints, that they can't simply step in and take over and control things and say, okay, we'll fix it for you. I believe that, you know, just like in Star Trek, the Prime Directive states that they can't directly interfere or change our free will, but they can influence us.
Yeah.
And that is what I believe that they're doing through telepathic contact, through the actual abduction experiences, mm-hmm. Not all, but in some cases. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are some cases that are very legitimate. There's also a lot of wackos out there who say they're abducted and they're lying and they know it and they just want attention.
Oh, of course, of course.
And you just got to weed through those. I mean, the way I look at a real, genuine abduction case is that, you know, firstly, the person has nothing to gain by going public unless the message they have can benefit all of humanity.
That's right.
And it's not like a cliche message, like, you know, something we could figure out on our own. If you really have contact with AT, you're going to be like John Nash. You're going to be getting math formulas, or you're going to get music that is going to transform.
Kind of inspiration.
It can affect you in any way. Yeah. I mean, if you're a scientist, you're going to get a physics revelation. If you're an artist, it's going to, you know, you're going to make paintings that are going to open people's minds. Like that Arcturian, you know, website you turned me on to, that was really cool art.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see how so many different people in so many different fields are actually being impulsed. And I do have to make a comment on something that you said earlier in regards to people in the government not having experiences such as the people who are having abductions, etc. I believe that in some corridors in the government, in all of the world's governments, not just in the United States, that people are actually having contact experiences and that there are things changing from within those institutions because of this. As they're having these contact experiences, they're having multidimensional awareness, and some of the experiences that you spoke of before during your meditations are happening to these people. They're starting to realise that spiritual power is where it's at.
Spiritual power and spiritual access. You know, I was a poor tree planter most of my life, but the power of the tree gave me the access to meet Jesus in person.
That's right.
To jump dimensions and visit other levels of our universe. I mean, I have experiences that most people would never believe in a million years. But to me, they're real, and I'm learning from them, and I'm, you know, producing material that one day, you know, might contribute to an advancement in science. And that is real.
That's
and
right.
And you can't laugh at that. But to them, power is about real estate and owning mansions and corporations and...
Yeah, but that's what I'm trying to say. I think that's changing, even within within the government. You know, it's not happening very quickly, I know. But I believe
but there are some very
every
more
strata.
Enlightened billionaires out there who are starting to open their minds.
Yeah.
Because you get bored of money. I mean, I've lived in Beverly Hills and had money and had a nice car, and I've lived in a tent. And I can't, I got to tell you that living in a tent, eventually I got a yurt, was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. And, you know, and I had amazing spiritual experiences living in that yurt. It continued for years, and then eventually, you know, I haven't seen Jesus in a long time, but, you know, he's a busy guy. Seeing God and all, zooming around the universe.
Yeah. So this really is all going to be tied in and all tied up together in your new book, Singularity.
Singularity is the newest thing I'm working on, and that it merges the highest philosophies and spirituality from very secret manuscripts on Jesus, that are, some of them are in the Bible, some of them are not, and also in Buddhism and Hinduism, merging with the highest ideals in quantum physics, which is called the singularity, which is a substratum to our universe that was discovered by Nobel Prize winner Paul Dirac, that is so pure and so, in fact, it's such a deep subject that I really don't want to trivialize it, but it's a level of our universe that if you can enter it, you can be anywhere in the universe in zero time. But the only way to enter it is to become so spiritually evolved that you no longer could produce war or any negative or destructive thoughts. And when you come into that singularity as a spaceship or as a consciousness, you literally have full access to the universe. But the only way to get there is to evolve spiritually. The criminals and the warriors and the mad people are never going to get to the singularity. But to find out what it is, it's so huge, this discovery, and with the help of Paul Dirac's theory and my work in spirituality and merging the two together, all of the big questions become so clear. You know, the Big Bang, the missing piece of the Big Bang, how space-time was created, the cause of inertia. There are three different types of inertia caused by the dual nature of the universe. There is emotional, spiritual inertia. There is the inertia of not being able to physically move throughout the universe. And there is the inertia of being trapped in space-time. And when you really understand how the fabric of all that is created through the knowledge of singularity, you become free inside. And it changes something in you, and you realize that you can actually enter this singularity, not just spiritually, but eventually physically. And I think that's what Jesus did when he resurrected. That's why he constantly spoke about the singularity in the Gospel of Thomas. For people who want to know a little bit of insight into singularity, you should read the Gospel of Thomas. You know, that's how he did all his miracles. Because in the singularity, there are no limitations. Anything can happen. I mean, you can build a galaxy, a universe, a planet. You can walk on water, you can manifest food, you can jump dimensions and interdimensional ships and spiritual temples. In fact, some of the evidence of the more angelic UFOs, the highest level of UFOs that are moving through the singularity, in 1968 through 1970, in Zaytun, Cairo, a district of Cairo, Egypt, there were 700 apparitions of the Virgin Mary, where she was even photographed. There were thousands of healings. Her body of light was actually photographed by black and white photographers. It was in the back pages of the New York Times in the late 60s. And no mainstream media really reported over here, but it was huge news in the Middle East. And above the skies where these apparitions took place, there are these balls, these light craft that are hovering above her. And those craft I have personally had experiences with. And those craft are not even machines. They are spiritual temples that are enormously beautiful architectures that move through the singularity and can be anywhere in the universe in zero time. And
okay,
they do that.
Oh, you've got to tell us a bit more about this. Now, how do you know that they're spiritual temples?
Because I've been taken out of body inside of them, and there's no machines. It's just vibration, spiritual vibrational energy that has architecture and form. And
what does it look like?
I think it's possible some of these giant light disks that are showing up on the NASA videotapes are what they are. They're disks. They're, in fact, if we read the book of Enoch, who was the first prophet in the Bible, after Adam and Eve, he has an encounter where God himself comes down in this UFO. I mean, it's a round disc-shaped craft with a window, and the archangels Gabriel and Michael are standing at his side, and when it lands on the ground, Enoch falls flat on his face, just like I did when I met Jesus. He can't stand up, and he realizes that even the angels cannot look upon the face of the supreme being. But he's in an architectural, you know, craft, but there's no descriptions of a machine. That's what I experienced.
It sounds to me a lot like the descriptions of a Merkaba.
Yeah, it's similar. Yeah, and Merkaba could be a light craft in essence.
Yeah.
But there are higher and higher substratum to the singularity, so it's kind of like there's a spiritual hierarchy in the spiritual universe, and the beings that can move truly instantly anywhere in the universe and other universes in zero time are the highest spiritually evolved beings. You know, when you can move light speed, you're still not moving fast enough at all. I mean, light is very slow in intergalactic terms. It's not fast enough. In fact, in my film Evidence: The Case for NASA UFOs, I showed how we could eventually cause a light craft to do faster than the speed of light limit by multiple times. And the way that I did it, the very precise way that I did it, using quantum gravity waves, 2 years later, a Cambridge physicist from England, João Maguijo, published a book called Faster Than the Speed of Light, and he did it exactly the same way I did. And I don't propose that he stole my idea. I propose that the knowledge is being transferred into the minds of science-like individuals, and those who receive it are able to understand it and, you know, put it into a book or a theoretical form so that one day we'll be able to go there. But once I, you know, was even able to go 10 times faster than the speed of light theoretically and prove exactly how that's done, not just like winging it, and the same way João Maguijo did it, I said it's not fast enough. The speed of light is too slow. In fact, the speed of light is not giving us a real-time picture of our universe, because it's only moving at 186,000 miles a second. And it's not fast enough, and you can't get to Andromeda in one lifetime. Andromeda is our nearest galaxy. It's just not feasible doing even the speed of light to get there. So when I was looking for singularity, I knew what it was called. I knew it was something beyond light. It's just something so remarkable. I would need a whole show just to talk about it.
Well,
and I did. I spoke on Coast to Coast AM about singularity, and I got the largest response ever I've ever gotten on any subject in my whole life. So.
Well, David, singularity, what you're actually postulating here is something that's going to become the grand theory of everything, you know, the holy grail in physics, science, psychology.
I think it will.
Spirituality and humanity. You know, it's a pretty big thing, and I'm not surprised. And I know that the listeners who are listening to this right now are probably very, very excited to hear you speaking about this, and so convincingly as well. Like, you really know what you're talking about, and you know exactly how to achieve access to singularity. That's what you're teaching, isn't it?
It's about access. And, you know, ultimately, that's what life is about. You know, when you look, you think about just human life. I mean, it's about, you know, who has access to wealth and who has access to living in Beverly Hills or whatever your desire is. But when you finally get to experience material wealth in the world, and many celebrities in Hollywood can testify to this, a lot of them get corrupt in drugs and, you know, sex addictions and these things because they're bored. The money doesn't really do anything for you. You have a certain amount of access to comforts in the world and certain pleasures, but that's nothing compared to having spiritual access. So when you really get it, you go, how do I get true access to have a real meeting with Jesus or Buddha or whoever your favorite spiritual being is? How do you get that access? And the way you get the access is you see everything in your life as energy with integrity. And when you understand that, to increase the energy field of your own aura, you have to do things from integrity and do higher and higher vibrational work in the world, that's what it's really all about. That's where the real high is when you, you know, I mean, meeting Jesus for me was, was better than any human experience I've ever had by millions or billions of times. So there's nothing that can touch it. So when you have that kind of access, that's when you're really rich. That's when you're really, you know, evolving. And when you die, you keep that access. Now, a person who dies who doesn't have much access because they don't have a lot of integrity in the world, they treat others poorly, they treat their environment poorly, you know, they're polluting not only their mind but their body and their environment. Your vibration energy is going to be very low, so your access is going to be very poor. You're only going to have access to very, you know, crude suffering realms, which are known as hell realms. So if you want to have access to spiritual pleasure realms and beautiful realms, it's all about integrity and vibration. So that means when we look at, like, for example, Buddha, one thing Buddha said that Christianity lacks is that what we do for a living, it's called right livelihood, really affects us spiritually, our vibration. So we have to look at what we're doing for a living also, as far as not just, not killing your neighbor and not lying and stealing. You actually have to do something with integrity in the world with your life, and that affects you vibrationally and spiritually. So if you add, I mean, Jesus really did say that. He said, you will reap what you will sow.
Yes.
So you really have to sow, you know, high vibration works in the world. And the more you have a true spiritual experience of enlightenment, you're going to want more. You're going to drop the, you know, the boring stuff, you know, the drugs and the you know, the booze and
all the lower chakra sort of stuff.
I mean, that
yeah.
stuff is fun. I did it when I was in high school. I'm not judging it. If that's what you want to experience, fine, do it. But when you're doing it, just know there's something way better than that, far better than that. It makes it look like nothing. And believe me, I've done all that stuff. I don't want to name it, but when I was a teenager, I did it. It was fun at the time. At the time, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world, but it doesn't even compare to this other stuff. But when I meditate, you know, and meditation takes a long time. It's not easy. You can't just meditate for 15 minutes a day and get blissed out of your mind. It's a life commitment. If you want to evolve spiritually and you're tired of the access you have, you know, when in your dream time at night and in your daily experience in life, if you're not happy, if you're on antidepressants, then your vibration is not attuned to a higher level of reality, and that means you have to do the work. And meditation is a lot of work. It's not just sitting and meditating to get high. When you go to a higher level of consciousness, you do get enormously high, but at the same time, you're becoming really connected, and you develop more, as you develop more compassion, you do more compassionate works, your vibration goes higher and higher yet, and you get more and more access. And, you know, Buddha said there are seven levels of samadhi, and nirvana starts at the seventh level, and that over many lifetimes, 400 lifetimes, he perfected six levels of samadhi, and when he was born as Prince Siddhartha, he had attained the sixth level. But to get to the seventh, he said, this is in the Lankavatara 8 Sutra, you have to come out of your self-absorbed bliss and your quest for your own bliss and do something for humanity, and then as an integration, you gain access to nirvana, the highest of all vibrations.
And it makes total sense, doesn't it, that would
yeah.
be the final obstacle?
Well,
enlightenment
can't be a self-absorbed,
exactly.
selfish phenomenon. It
exactly.
has to be an integrated phenomenon.
Well, it's to do with the fact that we're all interdependent. We're all connected to one another, and as soon as you... Well, in order to achieve any kind of enlightenment, true enlightenment, that has to be one of the basics of your understanding. And
mm-hmm.
so... In order for you to achieve that final level of samadhi,
mm-hmm.
how else could it occur except through service?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, through service. But it's a love, though. It's not like, oh, no, I have to take out the trash.
Oh, of course, of course.
Help humanity. You really, when I was in Jesus' presence, I really saw clearly Jesus' love. Like when Jesus said, only by me can you enter the kingdom of heaven, we're egotistical beings who think, oh, he must have meant only by me as an ego person. But Jesus is the whole universe. He is nothing but innocence and love and ecstasy and peace and power. And as I looked at him more deeply in the second meeting, I could see that he's always been nameless. He's not a man. He's not a woman. He's not sexual. He's literally, Jesus only is love. It only is ecstasy. Only is innocence. So what he's saying is, only by this love for all humanity shall you enter the kingdom of heaven. He's not saying by me egotistically. Because who is Jesus? He's not an ego. He's not confined to the body. He's not a Roman emperor. So Christians took that to mean Jesus is saying only by me egotistically, because they're egotistical, that's what that means.
Oh, yeah, or only through Christianity will you get you to heaven.
Yeah, I don't believe that for a minute that only Christians are going to heaven, and I'm a Christian.
Yeah, it's a message that's been very heavily
adored. It's only by love that you shall enter the kingdom of heaven. And that love has no name. It has no identification. It's a universal field. And so really, just what Jesus was saying, only by love can you enter the kingdom of heaven.
Let's talk
because
about Jesus a little bit more, because of your experiences with him. I have to know, how did you know that it was Jesus? And that's where I'm going to leave it for the moment, because we're going to have to take a quick break, just a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back to answer that question. You're listening to David Sarita and myself, Liz Miller, on bbsradio.com. Welcome back to the show. If you've just joined us, we're having a wonderful time with our guest, David Sarita. And we left you hanging before the break when I asked David about his meetings with Jesus. And my question was, how did you know that it was, in fact, Jesus?
Well, firstly, being baptized before the giant crucifix was the first sign of who I was about to meet. I didn't know I was going to meet him then. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I looked at him, it was an instantaneous it's beyond telepathy, because it's like billions, all the energy in the universe is hitting you and saying, I am Jesus Christ.
Were you able to see his face? Or?
Oh, yeah. I in the first meeting, I only survived 1 second per gaze, and I was so humbled and fallen on the ground, I couldn't stand because of the magnitude of his glory. But I kept looking, and I looked, oh, my God. And I would fall flat on my face, and I would hide my face. And
I love that. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, it's God. And then in the second meeting on Easter morning, that was 1997, I actually stood up only because he allowed me to, and I put my arms out of my side and looked straight into him. And it was like staring into the core of the galaxy. I was torrential ecstasy. I mean, ecstasy and love beyond belief. I was just crying my eyes out. I lasted about 1 minute, and I collapsed, and I overdosed. It was kind of like I OD'd on Jesus.
So do you believe that he was a historical figure?
He was what?
A historical figure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all these new... If you really study mystic Christianity, the Nag Hammadi Library, all these Gospels, you know, people who are saying he never existed, they're just terribly uneducated. I mean, Jesus appeared in the Americas before the first white men ever came here to Native Indian peoples, and they recognized the symbols in the church when Christianity arrived and thought that the white man was going to be loving like Jesus was, because their ancestors had already seen him, you know, during the period of the resurrection. So,
was that physically or non-physically?
Oh, well, what happens when the resurrected body of Jesus Christ can, you know, it moves through the singularity. It can appear in 1,000 places at the same time.
I see, yeah. So he didn't go
anymore.
There to visit.
The fact is, he just kept appearing and appearing and appearing, and there's too many accounts of the disciples seeing him after the crucifixion. And they were, like, for example, in the Apocryphon of John, which is in the Nag Hammadi Library, discovered in 1945, translated in the 70s, John is doubting Jesus at this point. I mean, he's been ridiculed by the Jews. They've been mocking him and saying, this Nazarene deceived you. He goes out into the desert and he's suicidal and he's lying in the dirt, fasting for days, wasting away in the sands. And he doesn't believe anymore because they're making fun of him. And Jesus comes down in a blaze of light. And the sounds are so powerful, very similar to what I heard when I went up into the seven heavens. And Jesus stands before John. He falls on his face and torrential love and ecstasy. And Jesus transfigures in the light physically from an old man who he never appeared as on the earth with a white beard, then into a young man whose beard was just beginning, and then into a woman. And Jesus says, John, John, why did you doubt? Why are you afraid? That is, do not be timid. I am the one who is with you always. I am the Father. I am the Mother. And I am the Son. So Jesus appears to John as a woman, and he's really blown away to say that he's the Mother. Now, I know from studying and interviewing Native Indians on Vancouver Island in Canada that the Nuchel-Nuth tribe elders told me that their ancestors said Jesus appeared to them, but he was a woman. They were really surprised to see Jesus as a man in Christian mythology, and that's because during his resurrected body, there's no perception of Jesus Christ as a woman or a man, but physically the form is so feminine and so beautiful and does appear as a woman. And that's how they recorded it. So there are so many accounts of the appearances of Jesus after the resurrection period. There's no way this could have been made up. This is the biggest problem they have, okay? If Jesus was a reformative myth the great Egyptian deity and Dionysius.
Yeah.
If he's a reformative myth, then how come the teachings that Jesus gave did not transform the world back then the way it did today? Why didn't Dionysius transform the whole world? And if he resurrected, where is he today? Why does the Virgin Mary appear in Egypt? And she's photographed in the 1960s, and she appeared again in the year 2000 in acid Egypt, and the BBC reported 2 million people flooded this town. They videotaped her body of light shining in the sky, and that was on the BBC News website, but nobody knows about it. Because, why? Because it's a myth? Because she's not real? Because she's really Isis and that Jesus is really Osiris? I mean, if he was Osiris, he would appear as Osiris in his resurrected form. And not that Osiris was...
Hang on, wait. I've got to say something there before you launch into the next sentence. Perhaps not. You know, last week's guest I had on the show is a pretty amazing man called Mellon Thomas Benedict, who had a near-death experience in which he was dead for over an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And in his experience of the afterlife, which was very, very interactive as he describes it, he directed the way it went. Mm-hmm. He was... moving towards the light, which he could see off in the distance when he first left his body. And he decided to stop the experience at that point. And instead of going straight to the light, he asked the sort of void that he was in, you know, what's happening here? Am I really dead? And before I go to the light, I've got a few questions that I want answered. And a sort of mandala of light appeared to him, which he was telepathically communicating with. And the light changed into the figure of Jesus, then back, you know, into Buddha, then into many other deities.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked the question, what's going on here? Why have I seen so many different deities? And the answer that he received was, what you experience on the other side is a feedback loop of whatever your beliefs are on this side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had to throw that in there.
No, I've heard
just,
that.
You know, just being the devil's advocate.
I've heard that many times. In fact, St. Teresa of Avila was asked the same question. How do you know when you saw Jesus it wasn't a projection?
Yes.
And her answer is the same as mine. Any projection or creative imagination I produced in meditation in my mind's eye, which some of them are dazzlingly beautiful, has never been so powerful that it produces more energy than the entirety of my energy. When I was in the presence of Jesus, when St. Teresa of Avila was, it knocks you to the ground. You're in a presence of energy that is so staggeringly greater than any human being by billions of times. You know you're in the presence of the energy and the form that is the Creator. Now, Buddha never claimed to be the Son of God. In fact, the Dalai Lama wrote in the book The White Lotus about Jesus that based on the transfigurations of Christ in Matthew and also there are extra-biblical ones, he said it's very possible that Jesus really is the Son of God, and that Buddha only claimed to have attained what we would call God consciousness or enlightenment, and that he was never intended to be a religion, but a system for the eradication of suffering, of the experience of suffering, and that it was really a psychological meditative method for transforming the suffering state of human beings into enlightenment. Now, I believe that enlightenment is an all-unifying field, and that, you know, Buddha is probably best friends with Jesus right now, but I definitely don't believe they're the same actual entity.
Agree with you, yeah.
Even though they live in oneness, like the family of oneness, and they're in the light, but Buddha is Buddha. Buddha was a man who reincarnated over 400 times to perfect enlightenment. Jesus always was enlightenment in the highest infinity, and he never was not. That's what I saw when I saw him. And that's what he said. He said when he appeared to John in the Revelation, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He never did not exist. And it's hard for us to conceive of that because we are born and we die. And then we're born again and we die and we go through these different realms. Well, when someone always existed and never did not exist as consciousness and as form, to us that's impossible. But actually, in quantum physics, you can prove it, and that proof is the singularity. But, you know, trying to just prove, I mean, you know, even the movie The Da Vinci Code, which is out now, they're trying to strip Jesus' divinity because he was with a woman. To me, that is so laughable. I mean, the very fact that he could love Mary Magdalene as his soulmate and love the entire universe just shows how much love Jesus has. He's not limited to only loving, you know, a limited perspective of the universe. I mean, he's in relationship, and he's also, you know, God at the same time. And I believe if she is his soulmate, then she is literally the feminine Jesus. She is what's called the Sophia of Christ.
We could spend quite a lot of time just on this subject because it's something that's very close to my heart, and I've got a few thoughts on it I'd like to share as well, but I can't. We've nearly run out of time.
We'll just have to have another show sometime.
We have to. We definitely have to. There are a couple of quick questions I have to ask you before I let you go, though, because I haven't quite finished with you yet. Thank you so much for sharing that information with me just then about Jesus, because it's something that I've wanted to clarify on this show for a long time, and you're the only person I've met so far who's had a face-to-face meeting with Jesus to ask. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a point in your life where you decided or you worked out that you had come here for a specific purpose? I mean, would you consider yourself a light worker?
Well, we all are ultimately, you know, potentially light workers, but Jesus did tell me, he said, you made this commitment to serve the environment before you came to earth with me. He said most of the people who made commitments with him before they took birth, he said they are becoming distracted by the meaningless phenomena of the world and they're not doing the work that they were sent to do. That's one of the reasons it's so difficult to manifest these necessary changes, because it's like all the workers are kind of, you know, skipping out of school because they don't want any hardships. And really, if we all these light workers got together on the planet and, you know, formed a consortium, we would achieve our goals much faster. But he said the reason it isn't happening, and one of the reasons, David, you suffered so much in your life, why so many investors said no to you, is because even the money people got distracted by the meaningless phenomena of the world. So, you know, that was proof to me that I had prior existence, that I made the commitment definitely before I came here. And I think many people did, and, you know, many are fulfilling their mission. And, you know, it's a beautiful mission to me. It's not like, oh, God, I got to work for God again. It's actually a joy to plant a tree, to have that relationship with a tree, you know, like Buddha did. You know, Buddha had amazing relationships with trees all throughout his life, including on the night of his enlightenment. I mean, when I was in India, I went to the place where Buddha attained enlightenment at the Bodhi tree, And the monks there say they have these giant footprints in the ground as a monument to say, when he came upon and gazed upon the Bodhi tree, he did not move. For some monks say 3 days, day and night, some say 3 months, and some say 3 years before he approached the tree. He was in such awe of the tree and experiencing the tree as God, because ultimately, you know, God is in everything,
yes,
that he couldn't move. He was in such awe, and his body suspended itself. Now, even if it was only 3 days, I don't know a single human being that can stand day and night for 3 days and look at a tree.
Maybe
so that's
you could.
Pretty awesome.
There was something else I wanted to ask you, and it was about your personal heroes. You know, there must have been people in your life that have influenced you along your path, besides the experiences that you've had subjectively with meditation and interdimensional contact. Who are the people that have influenced you in your life?
Well, I mean, ultimately my heroes, Jesus and Mary, but as a Catholic mystic, but really, you know, humans that have been in our era, Nikola Tesla, definitely my great mentor, Einstein, Max Planck. I mean, really a lot of the quantum physics guys are my mentors. But also, you know, poets. I mean, Dante Alighieri, St. Francis of Assisi, Dante Alighieri, who wrote The Divine Comedy, to me is the greatest poet of all time. And, you know, mentors, you know, of our day, there are certain people that I know that if I said their name, no one would even know who they are. John Denver, I would say, Dennis Weaver, you know, real ecologists that were really, you know, Dennis Weaver I knew briefly personally as he worked on this sustainable architecture project with me. And, you know, he gave his life for God and for the environment. You know, those are the people I admire the most. There are some rock stars, the Beatles, definitely Pink Floyd, you know, these, you know, they're mentors to me. Dan Aykroyd is a mentor to me, and which for me, because he was my mentor, because he made me laugh harder than any comedian ever, and then I got to meet him and find out that he was really the most sophisticated guy and such a brilliant mind. I was like, wow, he's not even funny in person, he's a genius. And you can talk to him about anything, and there's no limitation in the discussion with Dan Aykroyd.
And what are your tips for those listeners out there who've been listening to our conversation, who are on the path towards multidimensional or more multidimensional awareness, who are practicing meditation, who are doing yoga and whatever else that they can do to bring in that awareness into their lives? Mm-hmm. Firstly, what are your tips on how to integrate the information and the experiences that you have in meditation into your normal life? You know, it must have been very difficult for you having experiences like meeting Jesus and then there you go trying to tell your dad the next day and it just doesn't happen. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's not easy because, you know, there are certain people that laugh at you and say, oh no, you couldn't have met Jesus. But really, I've never, you know, when you have an experience and it's real to you, I never doubt for a second that it was a hallucination. I mean, a hallucination doesn't give you the Holy Spirit, the experience of God consciousness. So I never doubt my experience. So I would say never doubt. When you are meditating every day or whether it's once a week, you know, I would encourage people to, you know, rather than just believe in God, to, you know, practice prayer in a steady daily fashion, at least an hour a day, to see really good results. If you can do more, you'll see amazing results. And it's a guarantee. If you knock on the door, on heaven's door, every day, you can't just knock once and turn your back, and you just stare at that door, God will open the door. And it's going to happen. And it will blow your mind. God is the most far out being in the universe. There's nobody cooler. There's nobody who will love you more. And there's no one who can show you more about your true self than God. So it's worth risking everything for. It's worth risking your pursuit of material possessions, of, you know, fame and fortune, whatever it is. You know, I've lived in poverty most of my life. I've never had a lot of money, and when I do, it just goes right back into promoting something for the environment or whatever. I live in a two-bedroom apartment with my fiance, and who's a jazz singer, Crystal. And, you know, we have a very simple life. We're vegetarians. We're not rich. I drive a Toyota Corolla, which is gets 40 miles to the gallon. I have energy saving light bulbs in my house, and I ride a bicycle. I mean, that's, to me, it's just, I'm so happy just to be in a place right now, because I've lived in tents and, you know, been in all these different places in my life. But really, you know, simplicity, don't obsess with killing yourself on making so much money in your life that you don't have time to meditate, because meditation and prayer is going to give you more fulfillment than anything in this world, guaranteed. That is the truth.
Thank you so much, David. It's been such a fun time talking to you, and I really appreciate everything that you've shared. It's just been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Me too. Yeah, I really love your presence and your openness and your warmth, and you're a great interviewer.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to hear Australia, you know, one of the greatest continents on the planet. It's a great place. I hope to visit it one day.
We'd love to have you.
I want to go to New Zealand and just go camping and not have to worry about bears. Because I know you don't have any bears.
We don't have any bears. You just have to watch out for the tiger snakes.
Oh.
Yeah. they're sort of worse, actually, because at least bears give you a little warning.
Yeah, bears. I mean, I've seen bears tree planting face to face, grizzly bears, and they've never hurt me. I always go running and screaming, but they just look at me like, what's wrong with you? You know, they're not interested in me at all. I'm running down the hill. Oh, my God, it's a bear. It's a bear. And like, I'm just trying to eat some grass.
Best of luck with the DVD.
You too. And let's do another show someday.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do it soon. And, of course, on the new book, Singularity. Many blessings to you, David.
Yeah. I will send you an email as soon as it comes out.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Take care.
And that concludes another riveting dialogue for Otherwhere this week. Hope you all enjoyed the show. And we're out of time, so it's time for me to say goodbye. But I'd like to let you know about next week's guest. It's Lisa Renee. We're going to be continuing with our multidimensional / ET theme. With Lisa, she's a spiritual scientist, energetic healer, galactic and multidimensional guide, and quantum therapist. She has a website. It's called energeticsynthesis.com. So if you have a chance during the week, please go and check it out. She is an impactful and startlingly insightful educator, bringing new wisdom about our planet's ascension cycle, its effect on our bodies, minds and spirits, and how this new energy can be utilized for positive personal and global transformation. Knowledge is power, and Lisa has helped hundreds overcome their limitations, realize their authentic path, and live the miracle of a co-creative and inspired life. And that's something that we all want. And it's one of the goals of this show, to bring you people and tools who can help you do that. Lisa Renee is a telepathic channel for the Guardians, an interdimensional group of 12th dimensional beings focused on the evolutionary purposes of humankind. She's also a writer whose work can be found monthly in the world-renowned publication Planet Lightworker magazine. Again, find her on the web at www.energeticsynthesis.com. To find out more about my guests, I invite you to check out my blog at www.otherwhere.blogspot.com, where you can find weekly updates on all of the guests for the show. Or you can check out the bio page at bbsradio.com. Just click on Otherwhere. So that's all for this week. Have a blessed week, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in this week. Please join us again next week.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.